Hello, welcome to the Raw podcast. We are currently slap bang in the middle of the international break, which means there's no football. But fortunately for us, we're joined by former Sunderland kitman Stephen Aziz. How are you doing? Thank you for joining us.
I just think about international break there because that was the news to look really forward to be able to take a couple of days off. But then obviously for everybody else, it's absolutely devastated for 2 weeks. There's no proper football then.
No, I can well imagine. 12 years as a kit man at Sunderland. We'll tackle that first. Obviously, you had stints with Manchester City and Middlesbrough as well, which we'll come to. But my first question really is how do you get into becoming a kit man? I'm really intrigued by this.
Yeah, it's a question that I've been asked quite a lot, really. People asking, sliding the DMs, asking, can I get your job now you've left? And how do I get into it? It is really a tough one. Obviously, there's not many around. There's more than there used to be because most teams really only had one kit man back in the day, but now it's like some clubs have got teams of kit men. I think of Manchester City now, speaking to the lads there, they've got like seven kit men there and all singing and dancing, which you've got to have to support the team and to support the players. But yeah, basically my pathway was through my mum was working the laundry at Middlesbrough, so it was sort of a case of knowing someone on the inside that got me in.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, 12 years at Sunderland. I think your first manager, if I'm right, was Martin O'Neill.
Yeah, it was Martin O'Neill. Yeah, he was the first manager that I'd come to Sunderland with. And previously, I'd had managers at other clubs. But Martin was obviously a bit of a legend and sort of knew what you were getting with him. A bit old schooly sort of manager.
I remember that time vividly because I was a season ticket holder at the time. And when he came in from Steve Bruce... Obviously, when Bruce left, it was this sort of big deal because Bruce had been there so long. And that first sort of 6 months under Martin O'Neill was just absolutely sensational, wasn't it? The club, I think people forget now because it's so long ago and it was such a short period of time, but we were like second or third in the Premier League form table. We had results against, you know, Manchester City on Boxing Day. We were scoring worldies. I remember like Craig Gardner against... I think it was Swansea City and, you know, Sessegnon against Swansea and Fraser Campbell going against
I come at the back end of the Martin O'Neill, so I saw...
Oh, did you? Right,
I seen the bad patch. I didn't really see
What was Martin O'Neill like then during that sort of, that bad patch? Because it did actually turn sour pretty quickly for Martin.
Yeah, I think so. I must have sort of coincided with the really bad times, obviously, because he was a bit out of, not really probably himself and not really as motivated as you'd think this guy was going to be with the history and stuff that you'd seen about Martin O'Neill and... Mm-hmm. Sort of remember a couple of things briefly because I think that it could have only been a couple of months that we were there together before the managerial switch was done to Di Canio. But I think I sort of remember him being quite quiet and timid and not really this guy that I was expecting him to be.
Do you think maybe he missed his assistant because John Robertson didn't go with him, did he, to Sunderland?
Not sure because Wally was there and he was a character and everyone really liked him. Yeah. And he had Seamus, the goalkeeping coach, and he had a decent team behind him. So but like I say, Wally was a top man, good character around the place, and Seamus, the goalkeeping coach, good people.
And of course, Martin O'Neill made way for Di Canio, who is sort of in football infamy. He appears on many a podcast as Paolo Di Canio. Many things are said and written about him. What was he like from your point of view?
From my point of view, it wasn't great. I'd obviously left an Italian manager at Man City and then come into contact with an Italian manager was like, oh my God, here we go again with the Italian managers. And things started to change really quickly. And obviously it's well documented about the tomato sauce gate and there was all that was removed from the canteen and sort of no phones in the building and everyone had to sort of be on the best behaviour, let's say. There was no music allowed. I think one of the masseurs got told that he couldn't play music and the lads had to listen to music through the headphones. So there was no real atmosphere in the dressing room when you try and get the lads pumped and you look around the dressing room, there's guys walk around with headphones on. Mm-hmm. So you're not really sure what the lads are listening to. And I think from what I've seen over my time, we've always really had a like sort of designated DJ, whether it be me. I think at the minute it's Clarky, Jack Clark's like, honestly, that guy could be a DJ because he's just got bangers after bangers. And it could be something old or something new. And he's just got the lot. And I think the lads at the minute are always looking at Clarky for the tune. So they're probably missing that at the minute with him not being playing.
No, absolutely. What was it like, sort of, when Di Canio came in? The change in the group as well, because there was a lot of senior pros in that group as well, wasn't there? John O'Shea,
Yeah, I think
Lee
initially
Cannavale.
it was really good. Like obviously Cat Shays, like say Wes, good group of professionals, and I think really at the start it went really well. And obviously results come quick, and that's what you want. The initial impact of a new manager, that's what you look for when you're changing a manager, someone to come in and he, I mean, I think everyone did get together and get on board to start with, but I think it quickly become maybe not quickly because obviously we stayed up, and but then the next season I think it was a long pre-season and it got a bit monotonous and real, like it's again documented well about I think we were in for like 39, 40 days straight on the spin without any days off, and that becomes really tiring because as much as you want to work hard and the lads are getting paid with like really good money, it's really tough to sort of be in there every day seeing looking at each other for that continuous amount of days.
And again, people are only human, aren't they? I think a lot of football fans and journalists, myself included, were sort of guilty of overlooking that human element at times, aren't we? And realizing that these are guys and they need days off as well.
They do, yeah, they've all got families and a lot of some of the lads were not living in the area. A lot did, I think, at that time. I think it's a big deal that like if you're going to come to the club, especially this size, you've got to sort of buy right into it and you can't be commuting. Obviously, we've seen players that have commuted and not really come to the area and lived in it. And I think them, sort of the group that we had at that time, were really involved in it and they were in it.
Absolutely. You've obviously witnessed quite a few memorable moments during your career and had sort of an inside view. But one thing I wanted to ask about is what is it like when Sunderland beat Newcastle in a derby? Obviously, just thinking of Di Canio there, you had the famous 3-0 at their place. That must just be such a buzz to be part of. Obviously, you're from the northeast, not Sunderland born, but you've got a massive affinity to that club now. It must be an incredible thing to witness and be a part of.
I don't think I'd realised what it was like. I'd obviously done Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Middlesbrough, Newcastle derbies, and then to see my first game of the derby, the Newcastle Sunderland derby, was at the stadium. Like, I'm not too sure which game it was. I think it was a draw. I'll have to find out which one it was.
Well, was
Anyway,
it 1-1 when we got the last minute equaliser?
possibly. So, just on the terms of the atmosphere, I've seen like games, and obviously I've done Manchester Derby previous to this, and I've come into it thinking it'll be a standard derby, and it literally is much more. And the passion of like, I just remember seeing this woman, and she was screaming at who would have been the Newcastle manager at the time.
Pardew.
Yeah, it was Pardew. It definitely was Pardew, and she's just come from behind the home team dugout, and she's just screaming, swearing. And the game hasn't even kicked off yet. I'm like, wow, this must mean a lot to them. And obviously, we do the six in a row, and I'm really social, and I do like to get out and about. And obviously, because I'm about the same age as a lot of the players that play in this team, I get sort of dragged into sort of the social side of things, and the lads are going out celebrating after the game. And I remember a couple of nights we've been with them. I think Danny Rose, Carlos Cuellar, a couple of others, and I think Stephen Fletcher, and I was with a couple of my mates, and we just after one of the derby games we've come along, we've had a right good celebration. I think you just got to make the most of it, because you look now, if I could look back then, I think when will this happen again? It's the times are few and far between, so I really did like to make the most of it when we beat Newcastle especially.
No, absolutely. Back to Di Canio, he made way, and eventually we had the likes of Dick Advocaat, Sam Allardyce. What did you make of that period at Sunderland? Because it was quite rocky, wasn't it? It was just about sort of beating Newcastle and then staying up, which Sunderland managed to do, but the club just sort of never really managed to push on, especially under Ellis Short, the former chairman.
Yeah, I think obviously Ellis put a lot of money into the club, and it's well documented about the amount of money that was spent on players and wages and stuff. And it really was a time when Sunderland was just throwing a lot of money at things. And I won't lie, it was an enjoyable time. I had trips to Dubai with Sam, pre-season trip to the States with Dick, and flying all over, business class, first class, private jets, and a lot of things that you don't see that side of. I mean, social media was there, but it wasn't really showing you the real details of it. And I mean, I think we flew out from Newcastle to Las Vegas, and then we get a private flight from Las Vegas. We literally it was painful because I love Vegas, and we've literally landed in Las Vegas on the strip and swapped airplanes from one to a private one. Then I think we went up
Wow.
to Canada, and so you don't really see this sort of side of things. And it was really good times. I did really enjoy that period. Although we were struggling, we always managed to get over the line and stay up. And I think initially the Sam one was huge. Obviously, I remember us beating Everton at home, and Sam was on the pitch pumping his chest and stuff, and that was incredible. Like, so enjoy the last couple of weeks of the season, though, that you've stayed up, and then you can have your break and go on holiday. And obviously, Sam ends up getting the England job, and that was devastating for me because I remember speaking to Cookie, and Cookie, I wasn't on. The lads had sort of a bonus schedule, and some of the staff did, and I wasn't on that. But Cookie had arranged with Sam. It was Sam's going to look after you, like he's seen your hard work, and he's going to get you looked after. So next season we'll get you on the bonus, and then obviously Sam had left to go to England. So I was devastated about that, and then obviously Moisey come in.
Yeah, and just on Moyes there, what was he like? Because I think from a supporter's point of view, the shift from Allardyce to Moyes was quite stark. Obviously, there was a lot going on behind the scenes, but it seemed like there was something to build on there with Allardyce. I won't go into specifics, but like the likes of Jan Kirchhoff didn't appear to be managed as well under Allardyce, or under Moyes, sorry, as they had under Allardyce, players like Wahbi Khazri as well. It all just seemed a bit flat when he came in.
Yeah, I think that's what Sam was good at, and everyone knows from what he's done with all of his club team. Sam's really good at getting the group together. Like I touched on the Dubai trip, obviously we beat Man United and Wabi had scored, and Sam just really good at getting everyone together, sort of pushing in the same direction. And then David comes in, and you think this is a similar caliber of manager, and they're probably par of what they've done and achieved in their careers, but he just wasn't that character that you were probably hoping for from having Sam and being that guy and getting everyone together. David was a bit more probably maybe individuals and speaking to them rather than getting them together as a team and gel, and maybe that's probably possibly where it went maybe wrong for him. But I think he must have learned from it because obviously he's the bloody flying at West Ham. My dad's a big West Ham fan, and he's literally we've just been speaking about going up to the West Ham game against Newcastle in a couple of weeks. We're going to sit in the West Ham end and cheer them on against Newcastle. But yeah, to see him doing so well at West Ham, it's sort of a bit painful for us because why didn't it work out here? Obviously, there's more details and probably more of the backroom side of things that didn't go right for Moyes at Sunderland. And ultimately, that's why we're probably in the position we are now, because obviously things didn't work out and we get relegated from the Premier League after so long.
Absolutely. One of the sort of the main narratives that I can remember from that time when things weren't going so bad, and it would be really interesting to hear your perspective on this, was this idea that there was a rotten core within Sunderland, and it was, players that had been there a long time, Cattermole, O'Shea, Brown, all of those sorts of players, who were sort of consistently at the club. But to my mind, whenever there was something positive about Sunderland, that group of players tended to be involved in
Yeah, I
digging
was just
Sunderland
gonna say
out.
I wouldn't accept that, like, because seeing like Wes and Shazy, this core of people, cats, like you need people like them around. And I think it's something that the club's missing now. We don't have these, like, I'm really happy for Corey to be back in the group because I know how much he'll be pushing and striving. And just to sort of touch away from it, I see everyone slating Southgate about Henderson at the minute, when I've heard that Henderson's really one of the guys that really gets the group together. So although he's not doing it maybe on the pitch at a level, and obviously he was saying that he's obviously come back from Saudi now, but he was still getting picked when he's been out there, it's because he's a key part of the group. And what I think what a lot of the town of fans don't see is that these players who are not always on the pitch, they also play a huge part in getting the group together and getting them pushing in that direction. I think at the minute Sunderland don't really have enough of them around to sort of help the younger lads because we've got a really good young team, and I think with the support of some older experienced players, if you get that balance right, because I don't think you can just go for the youth. I think you've got to go with a good, real good mixture. So like obviously to go back to that, people like cats having them around, like I'll refute anyone who would say like we hung on to them. If anything, it's them guys that are keeping the team and the club going.
It's interesting that because there does sort of remain that opinion amongst Sunderland fans. But whenever you speak to anybody like yourself or anybody, you know, who was playing with them at the time, it's always refuted, which I always find really interesting. I think it was, you know, that rotten core sort of thing was probably driven by Di Canio, really, wasn't it? In the way he sort of came in, all hell broke loose, and then he left.
Yeah, because them guys, the ones who they got together and they said, we can't go on like this. And if you look back now, Di Canio hasn't had a job since Sunderland. So that sort of says everything that can be said about him. And the lads who've been in them positions, like John O'Shea is obviously interim manager, are now like, I mean, these are good professionals and they've been at the top of the game. And we were really lucky to have them around at Sunderland at the time.
Absolutely. One bloke that you mentioned that I want to go back to was you came to the club under John Cook, who was ex-Sunderland player and long-serving kit man as well. You know, what were your thoughts on working with him? Again, never hear a bad word said about him. And actually, when you speak to people, I've spoken to Niall Quinn, Mickey Gray, amongst others about him, and they say that he was an integral part of the dressing room, which is perhaps sometimes something we as fans don't realise that yes, it's about the players and the manager, but there's a big network of support staff, and they're just as important.
Yeah, they are. Like I owe my career and everything I'm about. I'm as a father, as a husband, and bloody hell, it's emotional to say because he's a diamond of a guy. Like, and I could not thank him enough. And when you meet other kit men at other teams, you get on, you speak to them, but you only meet them like twice a season if you're lucky. And Cookie, from the first time that I'd met him, I've not sort of come into contact with him previously, and I'd been around for like 6 7 years and I'd not really seen him. And the first time that I did, he was in his office at Sunderland and he sort of expressed that he was looking for someone to come and help him. And we sort of continued this conversation through the season. And yeah, without Cookie, I wouldn't be at Sunderland, and without him as well, and his advice, and just who he was as a guy, and his family, the kids, his wife. Just really good people, like, and some of them was their lives, and sort of by default, I'd taken over from John. It was a really tough time for me because I'm looking at this guy, and I think I previously called him like he was my work dad, and we just didn't have a cross word, and I could not have a bad word said about him, and everyone loved Cookie, and he was the heartbeat of Sunderland, and he was in that academy, and he was around, and he was different places in the offices, and it was really hard to sort of follow up after John, and it did really hurt me to see how things had sort of went, and obviously COVID sort of got the blame for that, and all the politics and the things, and it was really hard for me to take over. I obviously I took his job basically by default. We think both had to get interviewed for the job, and there was one role. And I was under no illusions that they weren't taking me because I was a better kit man. They would probably take me because I was the cheaper option. And I'm not daft, like I know that. But yeah, me and Cookie still speak this day, still got a really good relationship. And yeah, be a friend for me for life. And his kids, Zach and Jane, his wife, Janice, like, yeah, I hold them really in high regard. I can't speak highly enough for them.
No, absolutely, and that sounds like it must have been an absolutely horrendous situation to be involved with as well. Again, speaking to Niall Quinn, I think it was at John Cook's testimonial, which was brilliant at South Shields, and I asked him about the moment in the playoff final against Charlton where John Cook's the one consoling Mickey Gray after Mickey Gray's missed, yeah, the
So that
crucial.
picture's still up in the. I think we've got a picture up in the laundry now. It's
Have
like a
you? You're
picture of it
still there?
in the kit room. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
still up now. Because obviously that's just again I've taken sort of seeing that picture and obviously the times that we've had and the ups and the downs. You've just got to be there for lads as much as you the celebrations and you want to go and celebrate with them. When things don't go right, you've got to also be there to pick them up as well.
Well, this is it. And I asked Niall Quinn about that picture, and he said that was one of about 10 million times where Cookie was the guy lifting us up. And that, you know,
Yeah.
that must have been hard for you to come in and effectively be replacing your mentor, your friend, and a seismic figure at the club.
It's tough not to see these people, that people like Cookie, people like Cats Bawley. We should have them people around because they're the ones who feel everything in the club. And again, myself, 12 years being there, it's hard for me living in Middlesbrough, being a borough lad, I thought I was just going to go up there and I'll just see it as a job. And really, obviously, I've seen the Niall Quinn statement about something getting under your skin, and it really doesn't. No one can sort of put themselves in my shoes unless you've been there and seen it and done it and felt what it's like. And I think if any man would to be in that role and see what it's like and what it means for as long as I have, like, you can't really sort of give. Because I've had a lot of stick being in Middlesbrough.
I can well imagine.
Especially
I can well
when
imagine.
The beat was this season. Like, I was getting dog's abuse because obviously it was early kickoff. We previously won. Ross had scored last season. So I was given a bit out, I won't lie. But this season, after the 4-0 defeat, I was getting a lot of stick and it was really tough for
is
me
it,
to take.
Is it good dog's abuse or is it the, does it, you know, stray into the realm of bad dog's abuse at times as
no,
well?
No, it's good. It's all in good fun. But you can only take so much of it. So I sort of cut my night short this season. I was like, right, lads, that's me. I've had enough of it. But no. that's why we do it. We love it. And it's you've got to take the rough with the smooth. And there's been plenty of that at Sunderland.
No, absolutely. So we've talked about the club under Ellis Short, John Cook. Obviously, the decision to make John Cook redundant, that came under Charlie Methven and Stuart Donald. Now, their tenure at Sunderland is really well documented. There's a whole Netflix documentary about it. I thought my main question centres around Charlie Methven, really, because there's a lot of chat about whether that persona on Netflix is true to life. In my experience, when I met him, it seemed pretty accurate, to be honest, but I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that and about him and that ownership in general as well, because it was crazy. It was mad.
Yeah, I think you've got to take people of how they are with you. And I mean, Charlie was fine with me. Donald was, I would say, really good to work for me, and certain little things that I'd seen him do for staff and how he's treated some of the staff that are there didn't treat us badly. So with all the negative stuff that comes in, what they wanted to do and people thinking about their own agendas. I'm just speaking how I find them both, and they were both actually fine with me, really good, really. Then day to day, got on well with Charlie. He'd be in and around the place, and Donald the same. Didn't really see Stuart as much, but yeah, absolutely fine with me. So I can't come on here and absolutely slate them for the way they were. Obviously, the Netflix thing's fully... Everyone's seen that, but no, I think as much as I'd probably want to make everyone happy and jump on the bandwagon of slate them to, I can't really speak ill of them because I know that they've treated really well some of the staff that have worked for them through here. And I don't want to go into their own stories personally, but I know that they've treated people decently.
And that first season in League One as well, I think maybe it's forgotten a little bit, but for large parts of it, there was momentum, it was going really well. You know, Donald and Methven were popular up until a point. There was the double trip to Wembley under Jack Ross. From a Sunderland fan's point of view, like, that season killed me. So God knows what it must have felt like for you, because it showed so much promise and then it just fell away at the end, didn't it? And it was heartbreaking.
You know, what I would say is that we were, as a staff group and a player group, to be relegated, we were on the floor. And a lot of credit to Jack Ross, because he come in with his team, James Fowler, John Potts, Sammy, the goalkeeping coach, and they were just good people. And they knew everyone's name. And I found myself a couple of times, and I know definitely one of the players did, Benji Kimbioka, got caught out a couple of times calling Jack Ross mate, because this is how much of a nice of a guy he is. Everyone's with him. We're all pushing the same direction. And ultimately, when you get to these finals, it's fine margins, and it doesn't matter. Like, you look at Man City, Liverpool, these teams can still lose these games. It doesn't matter who you've got in charge.
Yeah,
it's just really is fine margins, and a lot of credit to Jack. He got the full group. He got the staff together. We were doing team bonding. We were going out for meals. He just really wanted everyone together, and I cannot speak high. I really rate Jack Ross, and one of the top man managers, people manager, nice person, and I honestly can't wish him well enough, because what he did for the club in getting everyone together off the back of another relegation, we were on the floor, and obviously to get to the finals, like, we were over the moon and we thought it's a done deal, we are going to get up, and obviously it wasn't meant to be. But yeah, I think that first season was sort of quite funny, because you think you're going to go up And let's enjoy these places like go to Accrington and go to all these sort of smaller
Yeah,
grounds.
a
And
novelty in the beginning, isn't it?
it was a novelty, and you couldn't get a ticket for a game, an away
Yeah.
game, and you're still getting all these fans coming to the home games. It was incredible. And you think it, and then obviously it turned sour by being in that league in the divisions for so long, going through so many managers. It was tough.
No, absolutely. That group, though, the League One group, so to speak, especially the first year and moving at the second and third years and fourth years. But there was a lot of characters in that dressing room as well, wasn't there? Post Premier League era. I'm just thinking that Lee Catmull was still there for the first year. You had Chris Maguire come in, Aidan McGeady, Lyndon Gooch. I know you're close to him as somebody that's emerging. There's a lot of, I want to say, mischief in that dressing room at that time, I reckon.
We literally, my group chat's been popping off this morning. So I have Max Power, Charlie White, Gucci, John Jones. We've got a group chat. It's called You What? Because it's just some of the bro had saying, Chaz, yeah, they're good guys. And like to say, to still speak from the staff, it's been so long. And we catch up every now and again in person. Like Gucci, yeah, good friend. But like them lads, Max Power, like he was really did come into the group. And obviously, he got made captain and got everyone together. Good guy. Family all come up. Got really close to them. They're sort of like now Mackhams, Scouse Mackhams, and they've come up and they've really just like I'm saying, they're really invested everything into. Because it could have been easy for Max to say, look, I'll just go up to Sunderland and I'll come back on a week and I'll see you. But they really got into the Sunderland life and the kids went to school there. And it's really nice to see when players come and they really do jump into the surroundings and get involved in everything.
Lugo Nine's definitely in that category as well, isn't he? Sort of, did you foresee him becoming such a big figure at Sunderland when he came in? Obviously, when he first came in, he struggled, didn't he?
I actually, the first day I remember Lugo 9 coming in, obviously not heard of him before, and he's come in with his agent, and his agent looked more like the player than Lugo 9 did. So I shook his agent's hand saying, oh, I'm Steve's kit man. What number do you want to be? Like, what size kit? Yeah, and Luke was like, no, I'm the player. Because if you see Luke, he is a bit of like a bit of a tramp, and he's like always in his joggies and things. And I think he won't mind me saying that, but yeah, I remember the first day of meeting Luke. Yeah, definitely didn't see him being what he is now. And I just like all credit to Luke again jumping in and taking it in his stride. And like, he's like a Sunderland hero already, and he's been through it all. And I found myself speaking to Luke quite a lot recently before I left because him and his wife have got a couple of kids. We've got two kids. I think there's a month between our two youngest. So we're like sharing stories. Is the kid sleeping? Is he, what's he eating? And we've become really close recently over that. And he sort of understands my decision that I sort of need to take a step back from this because I've got to put some of my time into my family life now because of. As a kit man, you've got to give up literally every weekend and a lot of hours.
Well, we'll talk about that because I have a little bit of an idea what it can be like. Sort of going away every other week, and you don't get a lot of time to yourself. But just how intense is a football schedule is being at a football club full time? Because it does become your life, doesn't it? I know it's become a massive part of my life, and I just cover the club. I'm not involved in it.
Yeah, so obviously initially when I'd moved up from Manchester City, I thought bloody hell, Sunderland's 45 minutes away. I can get up and down, and then after 12 years, it's like
It's a
it's
long
not
way,
quite
isn't it?
45 minutes. It can be an hour because the United's nightmare, and the schedule is horrific. Midweek games, overnight stays, long trips all over the country. Obviously, we're in Sunderland, we're the furthest team away from. Your closest game, obviously, at the minute it's Middlesbrough, but then you're looking at Leeds, Sheffield, and you're still like 3 hours away. I'm lucky, obviously, I'm a bit further south, so I'd always jump out and get home a bit quicker from the away trips. That was a bit of a bonus. Yeah, I think you've got to make the most of your days off. I think if you've got a good manager and someone who's setting the schedules and you're looking at days off, you probably could get like a Wednesday, Sunday off if you're lucky. If not, you could be looking at like 7 to 10 days consecutive days in. So for me, that looks like 7 to 10 days driving up and down the A19, which is really tough. And I've got to be the first one in. So I'm the first
Of
one in. I'm
course.
there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm probably the one of the last ones to leave. And that looks like 5 o'clock. So I'm leaving the house at 6 to get there at 7. I'm leaving there at 5 and get back at 6. So like it's a 12-hour day. Before I know it, I'm home. And it's an hour with the kids before they've got to go to bed. And that's what's become really tough for me in the job.
And it's speaking from personal experience as well, it's really an underrated thing being able to have 2 days off in a row in the same week. It's like
Yeah, I don't know what that
when you
looks
don't get
like.
that, it's really
It's
hard, isn't
you
it?
know, it's international break, and I think I've really made the most of like I think it's my 3rd week off now, and I've really made the most of being able to take the kids to school and doing all that stuff. Because like I say, international break was like you're looking through the calendar when the fixtures come out. I ain't looking for when we're playing Middlesbrough, I'm looking for when international breaks are, when birthdays are, and trying to think of it's just some family times. Like I say, I am a social guy and we do like to do things and get out and about, and football sort of consumes that.
No, absolutely. Just heading back to the football and going back onto the loose timeline, but I think we left it on Jack Ross. He gave way to Phil Parkinson. How did you find him? Didn't go too well for him at Sunderland. A bit of a tumultuous time at the club as well. There was, I think, fan protests from memories on social media. So, an interesting time to be a Sunderland fan, that was.
Yeah, I'll just be honest, how I find and how like I seen about Charlie and Donald. I remember I think Parky's first game, so I'm kit manager now solely, I'm on my own. And Parky was great. First day, I think we played Oxford away. And I think we had one training session travelled. And I remember coming from he'd sort of so what we do for away games is the players and staff will all eat together, and then we'll go to bed. And Parky sort of wanted to get the staff together and we'd eat separately. And I remember my first meeting with Parky in Oxford. He had a bit of paper and he was like, Stevie, pint my son. He used to always call people my son. And I was like, oh, I'd had a bit of a rough week. And I said, yo, Gaffer, I have a shandy. And yeah, from the first time of meeting Phil, and we'd had a fitness coach, Nick Allenby, who'd been at Bolton with Phil. And I previously worked with Nick at Middlesbrough. And he could not speak highly enough of Parky, and he was great as a guy in around the place. He was fine. He wasn't this big character like a big Sammy sort of expecting. But I think if you look back, I think we were really unlucky not to sort of get into the playoffs. Obviously, COVID cut that short.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but like I say, I'll let you know how people are as they were with me, and he was great with me.
Yeah, that was a weird one, that wasn't it? Because Sunderland had games in hand but didn't make it into the playoffs. And it was, what was that like actually, the COVID period for you, going from being in work to not being in work, and the whole sort of uncertainty around football? Because there was uncertainty around just life in general, wasn't it? It
I
was a
think initially
tough time.
being selfish, it was
Yeah, probably
great. I think
pleased, yeah, probably happy.
everyone thought, oh, a week off and we'll be back. So you're thinking, yeah, let's have a nice week off here and chill and spend some time with the family and the sun
Three
was out
months
with it.
later.
And yeah, and then bloody hell, I don't think anyone knew what how things were going to go. But initially it was really good. Like I won't lie, it felt good to think, oh, I'm not after driving up the A90 every day. And obviously Cookie was still around at the time then. So like we'll just see what happens. And obviously things transpired and everything didn't really work out great for a lot of people personally. And it was really like sad times in the end for what people lost and what everyone went through. And then obviously the club ended up getting stuck in League One for another season. And then obviously the project restart, Cookie's gone. We're now with Nike because we were with Adidas when COVID hit.
Oh,
And then we ended up moving over to the Nike deal, the 5-year deal with Nike. And I was sort of the first kit man to sort of bring the Nike stuff in. So obviously, if you're signing with the Nike deal, you don't want to see any Adidas around. Obviously, we'd been with Adidas for 5 years previously. So we have to move all the Adidas stuff out. And that was my initial job as I come back, was to get rid of and sort of move out all the Adidas stuff. And I think we'd done a deal with a company who took all the Adidas stuff, Classic Football Shirts. I think they took all that stuff, and the Nike stuff starts coming in. The players come in and collect the kit, but they can't come into the building. They've got to train outside. So like we've set up the kit van with all the new Nike gear and the lads are taking I think we had probably a bag or a box of kit, right? That's your stuff. You need to keep all of that. It was, yeah, strange times.
I'm going off on a tangent here, but what do you make of the modern day football kits in terms of like design and quality and stuff like that? Because I'm seeing a lot of stuff about how expensive the New England kit is, and I know when it comes around to the new kits being released, like Sunderland fans are always very vocal about what they want, what isn't provided. Obviously, you don't have any control over that as a kit man, but you do spend a lot of time with these shirts, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've been involved in the process, and I've been involved in the process, and I've seen the kits for next season. And Pete, like, this is a bit of an exclusive. I'm not going to tell you who it is. I don't want to get people following up saying what you're doing, but I've seen the kits are incredible.
Is it similar to the ones leaked online?
I'm not saying any more.
Right, okay.
They'll go down really well.
Excellent.
They'll go down really well. That's all I want to say on that. But yeah, so we're involved in the process and we're looking at strips, and that's really exciting for me because obviously I've got an 8-year-old and he's mad into his football strips, and the amount of strips that we've got is borderline ridiculous. But yeah, it's something I'm really passionate about and I'm hoping to stay involved in. But something I just didn't realise until you're in it, how crazy people are now. And you messaged me about this because I've been one to circulate on the message board to see what people are thinking about kits and if anything's wrong with them. And that sort of hindered me a little bit because I sort of care what people think. So I find
I'm exactly the same. It does get to you, doesn't it?
And I'm looking, I don't want anyone to say anything bad about me. But obviously, the whole thing with the badges falling off with the Just Sport thing. The first year, initially, that was just a sort of teething problems. And they changed that quickly. And everyone says, oh, embroider the badge. But these strips are so light now. If you put an embroidered badge on a shirt, it'll sag because it's just so heavy compared to the shirt, because the shirt is so light, because the players don't want to be weighed down, so people don't really think of that. But I think that story needs to be told better from the club. So the shirt out there, I think if you tell the story a little bit better about why we don't embroider badges anymore, and from speaking to the guys at Just Sport, I know that an embroidered badge is actually cheaper to do than what's the badge that's on there at the minute. And obviously, if you look at the badge that's on there at the minute, it's the best they've done. It is actually really, really good. And there's no badges falling off anymore. That was just the initial. But I think people get that in their heads that, oh, the badges fell off in the first season, so we hate that company and we don't want to be with them. But from working and dealing with the guys at Just Sport, I can't speak hard enough for them. They were a really good company to work with, and there were a lot of Sunderland fans working at Just Sport, and they obviously had the clubs in mind all the time, and we'd get a lot of preferential treatment from them, and at times when deliveries and things are hard to get, and we'd always be sort of pushed to the front a little bit because there was a couple of Sunderland fans working in there. I mean, the guy who owns the company is a season ticket holder. It's something that's been for a long time. And obviously you've seen the things with the Avec and the retro stuff that we've done has been amazing. It's gone down really well. And so all them little things from them, I really did like working with them.
I'm loving this tangent because kits is one of my favourite subjects. And I want to ask you, what's your sort of professional opinion? What is the best way to wash a football kit? Because I get this all the time from friends and stuff like that. Oh, I've washed my kit and I've done it this way. And everybody has a different way of doing it. And sometimes it preserves the length of the kit. Sometimes it doesn't. What is the best way to do it?
Yeah, I think just on a 30 wash.
Just on a 30.
Don't put it in the dryer, probably because the heat obviously is going to start taking some of the stuff away from it. But you'd have seen me in the kit room, them whites have got to be white, so I would just put a bit of the stainer on the whites, give them a little bit of a hand wash, and then we'd put them on a 30 wash. And I can't believe we're going to
honestly, because I get like, I've got a mate, Michael, and he's got like, he must have about 100 replica kits, and he's adamant that you put them in a pillowcase, turn them inside out, and that preserves the life. But he's a bit of an old woman, so I reckon he's just having me on there.
No, but these things are like important to people, and like you say, you look at the price of some of the England kits now, and we just had a Nike shop open up in Teesside Park, and I had a lad in there yesterday, and sort of looking at this dry fit Nike material, you can really feel the quality in it, and you can see why it is so expensive. And obviously, looking at the England kit that got put out, it is really nice. I do like it, and I look at the new Adidas kits for the Euros; they're incredible. I think they're absolutely class, and it is nice to see some new stuff going out and different, or like your everyday. So, but I think you don't want the same over and over again. As much people love retro, you want fresh, some new ideas. So, I'm really passionate. We should do something on kits and get together and do something like that.
No, I'd love that. That would be brilliant. We'll go back to the football because I reckon there's some people probably fuming at us for going on such a little tangent. Well, I think we left it on Phil Parkinson, but there's a takeover. Lee Johnson comes in. On the subject of takeovers, because obviously I think you'll have been part of three, all very different, but how, and you've touched on it a little bit, like how uncertain can that make a football club? Obviously, during one of the takeovers, obviously it led to your role, you had to reapply and stuff like that, but how much of an effect does it have on a football club, a takeover?
I think, yeah, it could be scary times, and it can also be good times. Cookie sort of, and again, the guy that he is, he said, "Look, I think we were coming. I think it was before Park had come in. We'd been relegated the season and go well in League One." And he said, "I'm not sure how things are going to go." And from hearing what I've heard, and the club's really uncertain. If I was you, I'd possibly try and look at something else and sort of get your name out there, maybe line something up, because I don't want to leave you in the lurch. Like, and that again just says everything about the man that he is. Like, just giving me a heads up. And yeah, I'd had a job interview up at Rangers and looked at other things. So yeah, it can be really uncertain times. And then Kirill had come in, and like from the first day, I'd never seen an owner in the laundry before, and Kirill had come into my office. And he asked me how I was. Obviously, he'd heard about Cookie and asked if I was coping, if I was managing. And I think that was really refreshing to sort of see someone in down in where the work's getting done, where the real work's getting done that no one sees. And to have that, and then I've built a really good relationship with Kirill over the years. And I don't know if people probably know that we play five a side together, the staff games, and that's something that's been really good and refreshing. We've had five sides out in Dubai, and we've had them at the Beacon, and I think we had one in the States in the summer in Albuquerque. So obviously Kirill loves his football. I feel like he's really invested in the staff as well, and I don't mean monetary wise, but I mean as time speaking and listening to what the staff their own stories, and he knows a lot about me, and I've gotten really well with him over the years.
So Kirill's very much sort of a visible figure at Sunderland. Then he's in and around the place. He's talking to people, because I think a lot of people's impressions of Kirill is that he's off here, there, and everywhere. And I'm sure he is at times, but from what I've heard, he seems quite present at the academy.
Yeah, he is. He's got an office there, and we see him, and you know where he is. And I mean, he's texted me a couple of times if he needs something, and I think that's a really nice personal touch, because I've previously Stuart and Ellis had not really. I'd spoken to Ellis a couple of times, obviously Stuart, yeah, but to have someone's like the owner's number and for him to get in touch with you if he needs something from you, rather, because he's got a PA Karen, so if he needs anything, he can just go to Karen. But if Kirill does want anything and he needs it, he can come and he can speak to me, because I think obviously he's built that initial relationship in the first place and coming down, so he's like quite personal, yeah. So he's approachable and personal, and yeah, decent guy.
We'll touch on Lee Johnson quickly. A figure who I quite enjoyed his stint at Sunderland for the most part. Gets a little bit of stick from Sunderland fans for being a little too wordy at times, and he loves a catchphrase, but what was he like to work with?
I think that's just Lee. Like, he just that's his own personal, and he's not doing it for effect. That's just who he is, and that's what he is. So I think you just got to take that with a character. But yeah, with me, fine. Like, I've still got a voice note, and I've listened to it. And from when he left, I think Lee, when he got sacked, he turned his phone off for a couple of days. So obviously, when a manager normally goes, you'll send a message, and obviously just touch back to Jack Ross. It is still known to this day that there's never been a queue of people long enough to say bye to Jack, and because that was just what he was. But yeah, Lee had turned his phone off for a couple of days, didn't want to speak to anyone, and when he turned it back on, he'd sent a few voice notes around, and he sent me like a really, really nice message. And I think it's refreshing to see that he did care. He really did care. He didn't just come for the ride and to come be at Sunderland. He genuinely thought he was the man to get the job done. And obviously it didn't pan out, but yeah, he was explosive, he was passionate, and I think it probably everything that you want in the manager. And again, I think people always think that they're going to be the ones to get it done for Sunderland, and just for some of these managers, obviously it just didn't pan out the right way. But like I say, it's fine margins, it really is. And when we got beat off Lincoln, we come back to the stadium, I mean, the atmosphere that day was incredible. I know we didn't get through in the playoffs that year, but the atmosphere is incredible. And you thought, when we got our first goal, we're going to push on here. And I really think that if we'd have got a Wembley with Lee, we'd have got it done. But that's obviously all ifs and buts.
Yeah, I remember that atmosphere at the stadium, like against Lincoln, because I think there was only 6 or 8,000 fans in there. It was the
Yeah,
first
there
one
was,
after
but it was
COVID.
loud, yeah.
It was incredible. It was a really good one. I think Charlie Wyke had a chance as well, which if that had gone in, it could have been so much more different. But yeah, Lee Johnson gives way to Alex Neil, who is for all is bad press nowadays about the way he left Sunderland. Is one of my favourite Sunderland managers just because of the way he came in and lifted everything. And to be honest, his post-match and his pre-match press conferences as well were always box office. Like, he seems a real straight-talking guy, sort of very different to Lee Johnson and Jack Ross maybe before him.
Yeah, and I'd previously had Gordon Strachan as a Scottish manager. So when he'd come in, I was thinking, well, is he going to be the same as Gordon? Unbelievable. Kept everyone on the toes, really drove everyone. And as spoke previously, I don't realise how it's not worked out for him at Stoke because you
Yeah,
see
strange, isn't it?
the amount of time and effort that he puts in. I'm not saying other managers don't do this. But he's so dedicated and he's so just, he was so good. And I think the combination of things of having the players and having the manager together, and obviously Lee's got to take credit because he sort of built that team and getting Pat Roberts and Jack Clarke, Alex Pritchard, all these players that we've got together, Corey Evans. Like, it's just a combination of all these things that we've got together. And Alex really drove us. And he demanded the best from everyone, even from myself. I remember one day, I think it was our first day back from pre-season, and obviously I've come in and he's like, right, where's the kit? I'm like, I'm just gonna see what size you want. And he's like, no, come on, we want the kit, we need to get ready, we're ready to work, let's go. And I sort of knew from that I had to be on my game as well. So I always had to make sure that Alex had everything that he needed, and he just really did demand everything. And there was one little story that when I was packing up the boots for a game, and obviously a few, I don't know if you know, a few lads call me chief, but that's like a term that I use to people. I call people like chief, just in general. I'll speak there. Hey, James, chief, you all right? And Pat Roberts has come through the boot room one day, and he's like, chief, have you got my boots? And I swore back at him, and I was like, yeah, of course I've got your effing boots. And Alex Neil walked behind him and give me like that real Alex Neil like eyebrow look. And I was like, oh, I'm in trouble. And he waved me over, and I've come through the boot room. And I was like, Gaffer, all right. And he was like, yeah. And why do they call you chief? I was like, oh, it's just something that I say and that. And he was like, all right, okay. And then for the rest of the season, he called me Big Chief. And he was like, Big Chief. And there was an incident that had happened. I don't want to go into detail of it, but he'd sort of pulled me and had a word with me and said, look, whatever's going on, I need to know about this so I can get ahead of it and I can sort it out. And we had a little bit of a moment after the playoff final where Alex had said, look, do you see how you play a massive part by telling me these little things that you know that's going on at the club? I can get ahead of them and I can nip them or I can help. If a player's having a bad time, if you know about any of these sort of little tiny things, you come and tell me. I don't think he wanted me to snitch, but he wanted me just to let him know that if there was anything that he was not sure on, that I should tell him and then he can get. And I think that's where he's having a manager and having a head coach is sort of different things. So having Alex as a manager and him wanting to control these little things sort of helped us as well. So yeah, after the playoff final, he sort of pulled me and he was like, look, do you see that with your help and sort of getting rid of these little things? Like, it was really nice of him to sort of come away from that part of us all celebrating to sort of see and show, look at what you've played a major part in this. And let me just touch on a little another one from the playoff final because I don't know if a lot of people know this. I haven't spoke about it previously either, but the suit that Alex Neil was in on the Wembley, because I'd seen it, obviously, you know that I trawl the message boards, and obviously it is nice to read the good stuff as well, but no one really knew that. I think Alex's dad had said to him that if you're going to manage at Wembley, you've got to wear a
Gotta wear
suit
a suit.
because it's traditional and you can't go out in the tracksuit. And he really did want to do that. So he's got his suit on, we've done the national anthem. We've ran inside. I've got his kit ready because he wants to wear his tracksuit on the touchline. And Alex Neil's like kicking shoes at me and throwing his tie at me, and I'm passing him his kit back. Like, it was like just a little sort of moment that only me and Alex shared, and me and Alex sort of knew about. And everyone was like, he must have been Superman in like a telephone box, like getting that suit off, or does he have it underneath him? But Yeah, like that was really nice little sort of to play a part because everyone was like, he was in and out like so quick, but there was like socks and shoes getting kicked at me, and it was like a nice little moment for us to have.
No, that's been one of the great Sunderland mysteries, hasn't it? How did Alex Neil get out of
Exclusive,
his
there
suit?
you go.
Yeah, and now we know. I think one of the good things actually about you leaving Sunderland is that you've been able to sort of post a few more things on social media. One of the great things from my point of view is that it's actually reminded us of how good that sort of playoff run was and the celebrations. You posted a great video of the celebrations in London on the night of the playoff win, which just looked incredible. I mean, what was that like to be a part of? And just on Alex Neil as well, sort of watching that video, and you only get like a 20-second snapshot, but it looked like he'd really sort of let that guard down as well, and he was able to enjoy it and have a good time.
Yeah, so he should, because obviously he's worked just as hard as anyone to get us there, and he's got to take credit as well. But just going back to the Friday, my wife's come down with my son. We hadn't had the youngest yet, obviously. So my wife's come down with my son. He's got his shirt on. He's Sunderland, like, loves it. And they travel down, they stay over, they come to the game the next day. And yeah, obviously, we get the job done. We go back to the hotel that we'd stayed at the night before. And we had a DJ, the trophy was there, all the staff were there, family was there, everyone celebrating. And then there's a group of us going to a nightclub called Rain in London. Like, supposedly, I didn't know about it, but it's kind of a big deal. And a lot of friends and family are there. And my wife's going to take my son Arlo back to the room. And I go out with a few players. And I think it was me, Corey Evans, and Corey's wife, and Leanne Bennett, who's football admin. We pull up to this nightclub, and we're outside and we're trying to get in. We've got a table booked at Sunderland. Like, actually, the Sunderland table's full because everyone's took friends and family with them. So there's no more room on the Sunderland tables for you to get in. And I think Jack Clark, I was with Jack Clark and Pat Roberts as well. And we stood outside and we're like, we're literally with the team, like, but you can't get in. So Alex turns up with a couple of friends behind us and he's like, I'll get yous in. I'm like, Gaffer, we can't get in. We're literally with Clarkie and Pat there played today. Like, what makes you think, like, no disrespect, what makes you think you're going to get us in? Anyway, he had the pull, he got us in. So we get
Oh,
into the club
brilliant.
and the rest is history. Yeah, that was incredible night. It was insane. The hangover was just as bad. My son ran into a table at the party, so he's got an absolute massive black eye.
Oh, dear me.
And we're going holiday like 2 days later, and we're just hoping that Arlo's eye goes down. It is standard for us though. Arlo turns up. He's running around with one of the, I think Brandy, the physio's wife, was there with their daughter Jessica, and Arlo and her get on really well, and they're running around messing. He runs into a table, black eye, and like, God, what are the chances? But obviously, we had an amazing night.
No, it sounds I won't keep you too much longer, Stephen, but just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of we haven't even really mentioned Lyndon Gooch, obviously, as I mentioned before, one of your good friends in football. But I wanted to touch on this idea of sort of the experience in Sunderland's squad or lack of. Now you were around that group, the likes of Danny Bart, Alex Pritchard, Lyndon Gooch. Yeah, they've sort of gone now, and it's left Sunderland's squad looking pretty young. What are your views on that? I know it's difficult, probably not to be sort of. Not to be, well, it's difficult to be neutral on that when you've got such a vested interest, but for me, it just looks like Sunderland are lacking something now.
Yeah, it's hard, and it's made my decision a little bit easier. It wasn't easy, but it's easier to come away when the guys that have been around for a long time, like Gucci, Pritch, people say there's no friends in football and blah blah blah, but I fight Gucci. I'm really close to, and when Gucci had left, and sort of he's the heartbeat of the club, and he's in there, and he knows exactly what it means. His family are all living, not his family, his family-in-laws, like, they're all Sunderland diehards, and you see him in the players lounge. My wife gets on with him, and like, the family just live and breathe Sunderland. And for him to go and take that away, obviously Luke's there, but I'm talking about a guy who's technically is a McAlinney. Come on, I mean,
Yeah, I
he's
call
been
him the
here for so
adopted
long.
Macken.
He is, and he knows exactly what it means. And I think to see them sort of people on the experience, it's tough, and I think that is exactly what they're lacking. And I'm hoping that the club sort of do realise that, and they sort of look at the model that they're calling it, and the sort of, maybe I think it's good to admit that, I don't want to say that they're wrong, but you've got to sort of, right, okay, we've got these young good players, and there will come good. There's no doubt about it. Like when you look at these players, injuries aside, if we can get that team out, the best 11, incredible. But when people like Ross are leaving, a long relationship with Ross Stewart, still speak to him, so happy for him. Got it. It didn't work out at Sunderland, as in let's give him a long-term contract because he is the ultimate striker for me. This guy will play in the Premier League. I've got no doubt about it. But maybe Ross's time, he's at an age where he's got to find that next security in his life because
Yeah,
he's
of course.
maybe coming to it a bit later. But again, great guy, Ross, Gucci, like these players, Pritch, Danny Bath, that experience, that core backbone of the group. And I've spoken previously, like Man City, we had Joe Hart, Vincent Kompany, Micah Richards, Gareth Barry, James Milner, English group of lads. Backbone, they're your spine of your team. If you don't have that spine of your team, then I think you're really going to struggle. And I sort of see now with injuries and lack of experience is why this is probably not doing as well as we did last season under Moga.
Yeah, I was just about to mention Mowbray as well, but he's gone now, which is a shame. You talk about sort of character and experience and know-how, he had it all. Obviously, I'm sure you have views on that, but it's so unfortunate that he's gone to Birmingham City and then unfortunately had this health issue as well. So, I've said it before, but I wish Moga well. In my experience, just such a nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, great. When you get a manager, you've sort of got to let them know that they can trust you. And obviously, changing managers so many times. I think Godsey would have been my 16th manager.
Wow, bloody hell.
So over a 12-year period, obviously, you're changing every year. So you've got to get to the point where you're like, right, this guy's got to trust me now. And obviously, people like Jack and Sam and Lee, obviously, you earn their trust and they trust you trust them, and you sort of work each other out. And it was sort of getting tiring that you've got to keep repeating this. And when Michael Beale had come in, I felt done with sort of having to reinvent and show these managers again that I'm trustworthy, like I've been here for a long time. Michael had sort of had 10 minutes with me when I told him that I was leaving. And he'd asked for a meeting, and to be fair, he was really good. He was like, "Look, at 12 years, a long time. It'll be tough for you, but I think it could be maybe beneficial for you that you'll look at something new and something fresh." So, yeah, I think sort of it's been a roller coaster, I'd say, and it's time to get off it.
Yeah, absolutely. What's next for you, Steve? Like, where do you go from here? Is it a little break and then come back in somewhere, or?
I'm having a little break now. I mean, I think initially, kit manager, assistant kit manager, that sort of thing's done for me. Unless it sort of have to be on my terms now, and I'm sort of looking for a Monday to Friday, a bit more time with the kids. I don't mind working weekends, but I really want to spend some time with my family and doing all the things that I see my friends doing with their kids, taking them to
Yeah,
football
of course, of
games,
course.
having weekends away. I've hopefully got something coming off that'll keep me really close to the club initially. I won't go into too much detail, but obviously the Instagram page, Stevers is the kit man. Obviously you put the link through for that. I'm sort of pushing that. And Middlesbrough invited me into the Legends Lounge at Bernie Slaven on Saturday. That was really one of the first things that I've done. And speaking out my time at Middlesbrough over the 4 years under Gareth Southgate, Gordon Strachan. And obviously a lot of people come up to me like, it's just nice to see this side rather than getting the players view all the time to see sort of the backroom sort of thing that goes on. It's been really nice, and it was a bit daunting. I had like 250 people to speak to, and they're
Yeah,
sort of wanting entertaining. And I've got a few stories in my locker that I've got from like my time at Sunderland and stuff. So, yeah, sort of Q and A's after dinner sort of things. Obviously, it's been said in the message board. My delivery needs to be a little bit better, but I'll work on
it's
that.
No, I'm sure that'll come. Final question to me, and thank you so much for joining us. But obviously, you've got this wealth of experience of football. We haven't even touched upon it. Maybe as we'll get to it some other time. But you were at Man City, the Aguero moment, working under Mancini. Allardyce, Southgate, at Bury. You've mentioned you've been at three pretty massive football clubs. You've got all of this experience. Does Sunderland feel to you like it's on the right path now? Because that's a question I get asked a lot from Sunderland fans. Are we going in the right direction?
I think it's hard because everyone wants the quick yes. And really, I think what I'd say to the fans is like, just be patient with this team. and support them, because with the support that our club's got, I think that's, I mean, I look at, I think with the 11th biggest supporter club in the UK, that is sort of something you've got to hold on to and sort of use as our driving force of this amazing support, and we've got to support them. We cannot be there looking for the negatives all the time, and I feel like it's sort of heavily a lot of negatives, and I think you've got to flip it and sort of be positive and back these players because they're young, they need the support of the fans. And I think for the whole, they do get it. And I think we've just got to get behind them and the team and Dodgsy and just support the lads. Just really give them your all, because with the support, I think it showed a couple of times this season, even with the backing of the fans. I mean, if it's nil nil, just support the lads. Just keep on supporting them like you've been doing for a long time. And yeah, I think this team will no doubt. It's too big not to be in the Premier League. Just obviously, I have no patience. Obviously, I wish we could be in the Premier League now and see us. But obviously, with the FFP and stuff, it's really hard because you've got to sort of stick to these rules. You can't just throw money at it. So let's be patient and see what happens. I'll be watching on keenly and hoping to get to a game before the end of the season.
No, brilliant. I think that's a good place to end. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve. It's been
No,
a
cheers,
real
James.
good.
Thank you.
Brilliant. This podcast will be available on YouTube, Spotify, all good podcast places. And yeah, thank you for Stephen for joining us. Brilliant podcast. Thanks for listening. Head over to the Sunderland Echo website for all of the Sunderland news during the international break. And we'll catch you again before Sunderland's match against Cardiff City on Good Friday. Thanks for watching and listening.